Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How would your life change if you popped the media bubble that surrounds you for even a little while? Few of us go more than a couple of waking hours these days without any connection to broadcast and online media or something to read, and most American adults and many kids are within arm's reach of a cell phone at all times. We feel like we need these things to stay connected, but are we actually just addicted and overstimulated? And what might we discover about ourselves by breaking or at least loosening these connections once in a while? Thomas W. Cooper is professor of visual and media arts at Emerson College and founder of the Association for Responsible Communication. Starting 22 years ago, he has not only engaged himself in regular media fasts, but has also led large numbers of his students to do the same. His new book is called Fast Media, Media Fast: How to Clear Your Mind and Invigorate Your Life in an Age of Media Overload. Tom, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. It's a privilege.
Start, if you would, by giving us a quick overview, as if we don't already know all this, of how much time the average American spends with media these days.
You bet. The average adult, it's over five hours of TV and 4 hours on the Internet. Often that's done concurrently with one playing in the background. Our overall media consumption as adults has gone up 350% in the last 30 years. Children have a different relationship, and I want to start with that because they spend 45 hours per week with media, 30 in school, and 17 with parents. So media is their primary companion.
Yeah, I read that fact in particular, and as a parent of four, it really concerned me. I mean, that's a lot of time with influences that we may not have any control over.
Absolutely. There was a man in Japan 2 years ago who, quote, married his video game, and that was, in a sense, a publicity stunt, but it's a metaphor for what's going on with children, with adults, and so relationships are profoundly changing by virtue of that.
So we're all using this, and I'll say all, realizing that I'm generalizing, but we're all using media more than ever. But most people, I mean, are doing it regardless of feeling overwhelmed. So what signs do you see that this may not be good for us?
Well, first of all, when you reach a saturation point with anything, you tend to want a respite from it. We have all kinds of people who are saying they want to go to nature more. Some even want to go back to the lifestyle of the Amish or the plain people and so forth. So partly there's self-indicators that come out. Most of us say we feel overwhelmed at some time or another by our media demands. In fact, Richard Werman, who's the author of a book called Information Anxiety, coined that very term, information anxiety, for all the people, which may be most, if not all of us at one time or another, who say, I cannot keep up with all my emails, faxes, tweets, voicemails, not to mention all the changing technologies, upgrades, the expense of it all, cable, the blow-ups, everything's out of date yesterday. And so that kind of subtle or profound anxiety, our sense of how can I possibly not be frustrated in this society, is one of the major signs.
You know, there's also anxiety for a lot of people that if they disconnect from their communication technology, that their friends, their colleagues, their associates will be upset with them for not being available 24/7.
Absolutely. And that's one of the first questions I asked when I went on a media fast years ago. I talked to friends of mine who lived in intentional communities or other non-media zones and say, how in the world could you get along without it? And they would tell me, well, if anything major happens, we'd hear about it, you know, through word of mouth. And believe me, we do hear about it, but mostly what you hear is not important. It's mostly slash, flash, crash for trash. And you could get along without it just fine.
What about the pressure of keeping up with, I had a conversation with some friends recently and they were shocked that I couldn't name all the Kardashians. And there's a sense in a way that you have to know this stuff to have casual conversations with people.
Absolutely. But please note that you're saying casual, and we could say informal and sometimes even erroneous. And anything of depth and substance, probably you'll be forgiven for, you know, not relying on the media for that conduit. Although I want to make a quick distinction between what you're doing, thinking, all about that, and a lot of the media, which is simply the 90% pollution in our consciousness that we'd like to have probably eliminated so we could hear ourselves think clearly. There are people who use the media in very creative, novel, important, pro-social, citizen-inspired ways. And so I want to make sure those people feel acknowledged and appreciated. The media is not the evil. It's our obsession with things, our excess, that takes us in places we regret later.
You know, Tom, reading this book, one thing that really fascinated me was that you started doing this in 1989. And the truth is, I think if a lot of us look back to 1989, we think, well, it wasn't so bad back then. We might have had a computer, but it probably wasn't online. We didn't have cell phones, most of us. And yet, even then, it felt like too much to you.
Even in the 70s, I ran across a documentary by NPR. I'm sure you like that.
Thank you for the reference.
by Lonnie Silver, about Television Anonymous, a group of people in New York who had their remote in their hands in the 70s and couldn't put it down 3, 4, 5 in the morning, and so they'd lose their jobs and so forth. They couldn't get enough sleep. Their family would disown them, kind of like AA, and they'd stand up and acknowledge this. So we've had problems in different sectors of the media for a long time. Right now we have addiction centers to get people off the Internet and so forth in Taiwan and the United States, and 14 other countries have been brought to my attention. I would imagine it's more than that.
You know, what's insidious about the Internet, too, is that for so many people, the things that become addictive are mixed in with the things that do relate directly to their livelihood. So you might need to be online for several hours a day, but invariably people are also sort of, here's a word that I know we'll get to later, multitasking and looking at things that aren't necessarily so vital.
You're absolutely right, Chris. And when I suggest that people take a media fast, even my students, it's always a practical one. It's eliminating the 6 to 7 hours of guilty pleasure a day that we could be using in more creative and productive ways, not the time that our boss asked us to spend online, not the time that we need when we're in an airplane and they show a safety video, and we better see that to survive.
Talk a little bit about that first media fast that you did and what the experience taught you back then.
Yeah, I actually felt a lot lighter and brighter after I took it. I knew I was on ground that was somewhat new and, you know, untested. And as a scholar, I wanted to make sure my research wasn't just personal. So I read a whole lot of the research around media deprivation and so forth at the time. But really, I was pioneering in a sense. I know others have done this. And my mentor, in a way, was Thoreau, because I realized he took a media fast of his day when he went to Walden. He really was tired of the gossip and the social conventional wisdom of his time. And so he felt he wanted to go hear himself think. It wasn't so much he hated society, he certainly had his friends, as that he didn't care for socialization itself, conformity. And so he wanted to have, you might call it a bubble or a womb, where he could create thought rather than experience it from others. And so, in a way, this is finding the Walden within. You can't go to Walden Pond per se. Today, I was there, and there was one kid texting another one just recently. But the Walden within is saying basically his concept has new legs and new wings in this generation. Instead of transcending location, we transcend our inner programming. The question becomes, who am I under my programming? And that's the real point of a media fast or diet, to rediscover self, purpose, direction, creativity, thinking itself, and go in new directions, or the ones we always wanted to go.
How is it, Tom, that, you know, as we started to use more and more media and consume more and more information, some of which is probably valuable and some of which, as you mentioned, is trash, we all seem to value taking in more information, but we've lost respect for the idea that we need time to process that information and to do something with it separate from accessing more.
Absolutely. Speed up itself has all kinds of, you know, advantages. Many of us wouldn't want to be walking everywhere we go in the world anymore, and so speed has lots of positives. But the negatives are when we take shortcuts, often shortcuts in thinking create more errors. And you'll hear from people in the media business themselves that shortcuts in production often lead people not to consider the ethical implications or the humane implications of what they're doing. I'm sure we've all had the experience of speeding up a process and then suddenly realizing there were hidden effects later or that we didn't do it right. So I think speed up is a double-edged sword. It provides all kinds of comforts and conveniences. It can be economically useful. It can bring people together in a lot better ways sometimes. But speed up has this hidden, seamy underbelly of constantly making us realize after the fact, like a paper cut, what didn't we consider? And it can burn us out physiologically and psychologically as well.
Well, speed up is such an interesting concept. You also talk about the idea that we in our language are constantly talking about how little time we have without mm-hmm. thinking about the effect that our priorities have on the amount of time we perceive we have.
Absolutely. There's an entire chapter in the book about that, about how you come to terms with where you should spend your time, when you should speed up, when you should slow down, who it is that you are, and therefore what it is you wish to set aside time to do. We don't do that when we become enslaved to certain media habits or even media addictions, the agenda set for us by whoever does the programming.
And there's also this state where we reach a sort of paralysis if, you know, we watch enough TV or read enough magazines or whatever, that all of them have advice for what we should be doing with our lives. And we get to the point where we think, well, I can't possibly live like Martha Stewart and be the world's best parent in terms of educating my kids and do these 11 other things. So I'll just keep reading about it and not get any of it done.
Right, Chris. And under that, they have another bit of advice for what all of us should be doing all the time, except NPR. And that is, there's something wrong with you, buy something.
Yeah.
And so from a very early age, our children learn, you know, consuming is the answer rather than creating, rather than expressing, rather than thinking. And so therefore, we have huge obesity problems, not just physical, but psychologically. We're obese. We carry around. I wake up singing, I'm a material girl, or I'm Katy Perry's Teenage Dream. Clearly, I'm neither. I'd like to think that I had my own thoughts available if I'm trying to add up math on my bank budget or whatever else. But other people's thoughts are intravenously recycled all the time, and this creates less and less space for us to think creatively. I even ask my students, who among you has had an original thought?
Hmm.
And that provokes a lot of thought.
You know, it strikes me how many people say they do their best thinking in the shower, and that's maybe the one and only place where there is no access to media.
Yet.
That's true. I guess they've got those shower radios and things, but
you
got
to put the word "yet" back of every phrase these days.
Talk about your students. You're teaching this generation of absolute digital natives that have never known a house without a PC and have never been disconnected from the world. Are they more or less open to the idea that a media fast could be a valuable thing?
Well, first of all, I love my students because, you know, there are a lot of older professors who think these kids don't know anything. They don't know what print is anymore, or what. I don't see it that way at all. Mm-hmm. They're kind of learning new languages and worlds to teach the rest of us, and so I'm very appreciative of them. And I find that many of them are looking for some key to go deeper into their own thinking, to originate thought, to be more creative, to try something totally different, to not just regurgitate facts and spit them back on an exam. So those kinds of students are often very excited to do something both experiential and intellectual that has freshness attached to it. So many students, and in fact, I have a whole chapter in the book on how teachers can take their students on a media fast and so forth, or other groups for that matter. And those group dynamics often emerge very positively. We divide the class into three groups, those on a practical media fast, which is not the same as a blackout. They just cut out the media they can. Those on a media diet, which means they change their intake. Maybe they want to confront their Facebook addiction and leave only that behind, or their headset addiction, or whatever else. And so they create a media diet the way you'd have a food diet, which may mean more of this, less of that.
Mm-hmm.
The third group serve as a monitor, and I call them the media mirror group. They're mirroring their own habits to themselves. They're taking diaries every time they get in a car, turn on the remote radio or whatever. They realize, oh, this is controlling me rather than I chose to do this.
Yeah.
They get home, they pick up the remote. Oh, I'm habituated to this rather than I'm choosing to watch a particular program at this time over all the other options.
Let me jump in here for a minute. We have to take a quick break, Tom.
I'm sorry.
That's quite all right. We're with Thomas W. Cooper, professor of visual and media arts at Emerson College and author of the new book, Fast Media, Media Fast, How to Clear Your Mind and Invigorate Your Life in an Age of Media Overload.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
Chris Boyd, you're listening to an archive edition of Think. My guest this hour is Thomas W. Cooper, professor of media, of visual and media arts at Emerson College. His new book is called Fast Media, Media Fast, How to Clear Your Mind and Invigorate Your Life in an Age of Media Overload. So, Tom, before the break, you were telling us that when you do this with your students, you'll separate them into three groups. You have the ones doing a practical fast, the ones doing a media diet, and then the ones who are simply monitoring their regular use. What happens at the end of the experiment when they come back together and talk about this?
They do come back together, and they exchange notes, and some of them are fascinated by what each other have learned. I don't want to paint a romantic picture. A media fast or even a diet isn't for everyone. I've had a few students who've been very reluctant at the beginning. Mostly by the end, they say, wow, what a great experience. But I've had a couple who, even after the entire experience, said, oh, I gave up my guilty pleasures. I would have been much happier if I had my addiction, you know. So they may realize that it is an addiction, but that doesn't mean they can live without it. So I don't want to give a romantic perspective, but I would say 80 to 90% say, wow, I really learned something about society, about the media, about myself, about advertising, about the people around me, and I may never be the same again. Some even go to the extreme of taking a media fast in the summer, because during class you can't really do all the things outdoors, back to nature and sports and all of that, that you can do when June and July roll around. So I've had the full spectrum, and I'll get emails, cards, so forth, from students years later who say, you know, this is the one thing that really woke me up in college, and that makes you feel, you know, wow, I better be doing more of this, and I better keep learning from my students. They give me good feedback to tailor it and alter it over the years.
What's the difference between us in America, in 21st century America, and cultures that, for a variety of different reasons, are really not in contact with a lot of media?
Great. There are two chapters in the book that deal with that. One, no media zones, such as the Amish, what we call the plain people, and certain tribes that exclude all media from their existence. There are others that we call the low media zones, where, like the Rapa Nui, who have had basically just one TV channel from Chile that feeds into their culture, one newspaper, and there are many other groups like that. And you can learn from both types of groups. Each is unique, just as they can learn from us. For example, when I lived with the Amish deliberately to see why they didn't have media and so forth, I might walk into a home and hear people singing together or playing a game together, a board game or something, and having the kind of experience that some people long for. If I go into a suburban home here, there are exceptions, and each one is different, but I may hear, you know, loud music coming out of one room with the door open, sports coming out of another room nonstop with the door open, another door closed because the third person is, you know, getting as much porn as possible without letting anybody know it, and that's not a secret. America is addicted to porn, 25% of media consumption and so forth. And so, and then another
Wait,
door.
Excuse me for interrupting. 25% of media consumption in this country relates to
pornography. Overall media industry, if we can, I mean, look at the internet and what comes to you without even inviting it.
Wow.
So it's a huge mega million billion dollar industry these days. And then the door is open in another room and two people are shouting at each other. So I ask you, what kind of family is that that we're becoming? There are exceptions to that, and I know that you can walk into neighborhoods where many families are basically happy, but the media is fragmented, our society. We have all kinds of different levels of mediation, and I don't want to generalize about them, but on the whole, we find that young people are listening to one subculture, adults are listening to several subcultures, not all of which talk to each other. Children have their own that's recycled to them again and again through DVD and now online and so forth. And so are we becoming a culture that can talk to each other anymore? And if so, is it about deep, meaningful things, or is it about whether Casey Anthony's guilty or innocent?
Yeah, well, you know, that's a remarkable, a really interesting point to go to, is the fact that everything is so individualized for people. I mean, I will say as a kid, I probably watched more TV than I should have, and I've tried to be more careful with my own kids, but at least we were like a one television set family, so you had to talk to somebody else about what you were going to watch and negotiate and then watch it together. And now every device we invent makes it a more and more personal experience, so you could be in the same room with five other people and watch five different things.
Absolutely. And that's not likely to happen in many of the low media zones and no media zones. But I do want to let you know that there's a downside to all of this. For example, if I lived in an Amish community 5 miles away from a nuclear reactor and it was about to melt down, I would have no way of knowing that immediately. And so
yeah.
Wouldn't you want to know if a hurricane's coming tomorrow or a blizzard's coming tomorrow or whatever else? So the downside is equally replaced by the upside of media exposure, and cultures without media could learn a lot if they chose to from media-saturated cultures. For example, we have access to all the other cultures in the world, and they don't.
Yeah, that's a great point, and we can be exposed to different ideas through the media.
Constantly.
Let's go to the phones now, because we've got a full board of callers here at 1-800-933-5372. First, we'll speak with Jake in Denton. Hey, Jake.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Well, I've been without a Facebook for about a year now, and whenever I meet new people and they try to find me on Facebook, they're like, hey, I can find you on Facebook. I tell them I don't have a Facebook, and I generally get one of two reactions. One of them is like, oh, my God, how can you live without a Facebook? Hmm. And the other is, that's great, good for you. And so I'm wondering, why are people polarized on this? What makes this, like, people either they feel like they have to have it, oh, my God, you're living under a rock, you don't have it, or they're like, that's great, I wish I could live without it.
Yeah, you know, the amazing thing about that, Tom, what Jake is saying, is that Facebook's only been around for, what, 5 or 6 years, and already it feels this vital to so many people.
Mm-hmm. So we are social beings on the one hand. I appreciate Jake's question. And therefore, when we appear to be antisocial in any way, even if it's a false appearance, we can understand why we get negative feedback. On the other hand, we avoid cultism. And when something that's socialized becomes cultic, that is to say, it's predictable, we feel like you're not individual or independent anymore when you have to have it, we have a bit of resistance to that. So that's why the double edge. We don't want to be seen as unthinking. We don't want to be seen as following the crowd exclusively. On the other hand, we don't want to be seen as hermits. So both of those forces are going on inside us.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We have an email here from Paul T. in Dallas, who writes, in 1930, I was at a remote radar site in Alaska. No radio, TV, newspapers, etc. I read out the library, choosing books by thickness so they would last longer. Again, for 2 years, starting in 1975, I lived off the ice cap of Greenland. We did sometimes pick up CBC off the microwave, otherwise no media at all. Read out that library also. What an interesting experience that Paul had.
Yeah, great. I appreciate Paul, and in fact may interview him for my next edition if he identifies himself. I love finding people like this, and by the way, he's not alone. When you write a book like this, you find out all kinds of people come out of the underground and say, you know, I've been doing this and didn't know other people were doing it. Some people reach a saturation point, but others just choose to live in an environment where there's low media access. So I appreciate his experience. He obviously did some thinking for himself.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Heather in Dallas. Hi, Heather.
Hi. I was listening to the discussion of cultures that don't have a lot of media, and reminded me that we are Jewish, and so we celebrate the Sabbath every week. And it feels like a commanded time for us to spend together as a family, because part of our observance is absolutely no electronics whatsoever.
Huh.
So we spend 24 hours interacting with each other, going for walks, swimming, playing games. And my children grow up knowing you can actually tune out for a little bit of time and the world won't end.
What a great experience. Have they always been fine with this because they've known nothing else?
Oh, no. As they get older and they're more hooked into video games and different media, there's a little bit of resistance every week. But I just emphasize this is important. This is what we do. And we find other ways to enjoy each other's company. But I actually had a question about whether or not your guest has done any studies on the correlations between depression and excessive media consumption. I know he talked about it being an addiction, but I know from experience with friends that as they got their depression under control, it turned out that they could do other things, and they ended up relying less and less on always having the TV on in the background or always having something going.
Huh.
That kind of numbed their brains. So I was wondering if he had any thoughts on that.
What do you know about that, Tom?
Thanks. I have no experience with clinical studies on the relationship between depression and media saturation. But here's what I can tell you. I've just put together all of the studies that are major studies on what's happening to children in their relationship to the media. And the greater the excessive consumption of mainstream entertainment media, the higher the odds a child will become obese, ADD, alcohol or tobacco dependent, academically mediocre or poor, housebound, prematurely sexually active or pregnant, violent, or and distant, if not alienated from parents and peers. So that's quite a list, and we wonder why depressed isn't in there. It may well be when we have sufficient studies. In other words, if you are so bored with your life that all you can do is constantly consume and so forth, just like the limits of obesity, or you become frustrated and depressed, when your life is totally media-generated, you have no exercise, you have no light, so forth and so on, would you not be ultimately depressed with your life? So just something to think about.
Have those studies proved a causal relationship between those factors, or is there perhaps just a correlation? Maybe people who have all these problems are more likely to turn to media to get away from them.
The greater the excess, and again, this is children now, not all age groups, but if you put all the children's studies together, it tends toward causality, but as a scholar, you have to be very careful to say, just because I consume a lot of media doesn't mean that I'll have all these effects, because there are many exceptions to almost everything.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next on the phone to Eileen in Tyler. Hey, Eileen.
Hi, I am delighted to have the opportunity to comment to you and to your guests. We have been television-free in our household since the late 1960s. Our children played musical instruments, they read books, they interacted with friends, they rode bicycles, they did all kinds of things. That is not to say they didn't watch television at friends' houses. We certainly knew, you know, they certainly did that. And when there was something very important on television, we would gather with friends and do it as a social event, which took it out of that isolation. I guess my most important comment is that our children, who are now obviously on their own and have their own households, have also chosen to be television-free, and our son and daughter-in-law are choosing to rear their children in a television-free environment.
Well, obviously it worked well for you guys. Thank you so much for your call, Eileen.
You're welcome.
Any response to that, Tom?
Yes, thanks to Eileen. There are many groups out there that actually advocate what she's doing. Waldorf, Montessori, many of the alternative schools like to see children not have dependencies on media. So she's not alone, and I'm sure she knows that. And the fact that it's being perpetuated in her family is in a way quite exciting. What I want to make it clear is that I'm not a media basher, so I personally use television. And yet, for me, it's the dosage that needs to be limited. It's not cutting something out of our lives, although I appreciate many people who have gone without TV have certainly had a great experience.
What, when you're telling someone about the possibility of doing something like a media fast or a media diet, is there an amount of time that you suggest they carve out for their initial experiment with this sort of thing?
Right. Typically in my classes, it's a 3-week experiment. I've done things in the summer where people are more free and can go up to a month. But you can get some of the benefits even in just a weekend. If you've ever been to the country for a weekend or, you know, out camping, you come back and you feel refreshed and your mind feels cleared, or a boat trip for that matter. So it really is customized to the individual. But I'm a media person myself. I used to do a lot of production. You can probably relate, and go into a room without windows for days and then emerge. Sometimes to cleanse that takes a full week.
Yeah. Yeah, there were times when I did a lot more TV work that the last thing I would want to do when I got home would be to flip on the television set.
Right. So it's really customized to the individual, and that's why the book doesn't say everybody take a media fast. It has media blackouts, media fast, media diets, group fast, solo. Everything is available at the level that people find interest.
I have to imagine there's some value even in media mindfulness, that control group that you have in your classes that simply writes down everything that they're doing.
Absolutely. When you start thinking about it, you realize, oh, who am I under my media programming? Who did I want to be as a child? What are the things I really wanted to do? And so you can do that even while you're watching the media.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Brett in Burleson. Hi, Brett.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had an observation. It's really uncanny how media fueled alienation between generations pops up its head in several places. As someone who's grown up in church and is a musician, I have noticed that phenomenon for years and years, where different generations take their favorite if I may use the phrase, media-soaked preferences for certain kinds of music, and people in church will end up fighting with each other over music, and it's often generationally divided, the fights. I like this kind, I like that kind. And now it's such a fast-paced environment, the music industry, you can almost make the case that you have a generation every 5 to 10 years. And so now there are even more segments to fight about and alienate each other from. So I thought that was just interesting. The reason I thought of that is that you mentioned the Amish. So that got my mind thinking about religious issues. So this is a fascinating program. Thank you so much.
Thanks for your call. We've got about 30 seconds before we take a break, Tom, if there's anything you want to say about what Brett told us.
I think Brett's right on. It's powerful. And all the people have been phoning in today. I appreciate people are thinking for themselves about this.
Thomas W. Cooper is my guest. He's a professor of visual and media arts at Emerson College. His new book is called Fast Media, Media Fast, How to Clear Your Mind and Invigorate Your Life in an Age of Media Overload. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
Listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Thomas W. Cooper is my guest. He's professor of visual and media arts at Emerson College and author of the new book Fast Media, Media Fast, How to Clear Your Mind and Invigorate Your Life in an Age of Media Overload. Tom, do you find that most people emerge from a temporary media fast only to make some longer-term changes in their media consumption?
Probably about a third, based on all the classes that I've had. In other words, a lot of people, when they emerge from a food diet, they intend to stay at that weight. And a
if
lot of people,
only
that's
that stuck, yeah.
When they emerge from a media diet, they intend to keep the lessons intact. Mm-hmm. But the addiction of food, like the of certain kinds of food, like the addiction of media, like the addiction of drugs, and so forth and so on, very seductive. And over time, many of us go back to our previous guilty pleasures or habits, and I don't want to put that down. I have mine, and the media can be therapeutic sometimes if we go back to something that's not particularly intellectual or stimulating or so forth and so on. So there's a space for everything in my world. But to answer the question, probably about a third find this very useful in the long term, a third find it useful in the short term and intend to keep those changes in their long term. But just like a food fast or a food diet, you tend to go back to habits.
Let's go back to the phones now at 800-933-5372. This time I want to talk to Sakina in Dallas. Hi, Sakina.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Oh, my God, thank you so much. I can't believe I got through. I listen to your program every single day, so I just wanted to thank you for putting knowledge out into the world.
Well, thanks for listening.
My question is, I'm African-American. And my kids are African-American. My husband's Native American, African-American. And the influence of media, and I'm talking more about the entertainment on African-Americans, is very, very detrimental. Why is the media targeting our children? Why is it targeting our youth? Just yesterday, my son told me F-U at the park, and he's 3 years old. I've never said that. My husband's never said that. I was shocked. I was taken aback. I didn't know how to respond, but I knew that he got it from a movie or something that, you know, he saw on TV. As soon as we got home, I took all the DVDs out of his room. I took his television out of his room. And, you know, he was crying and he was screaming. But I'm trying to figure out, why is the media targeting our youth?
Tom, do you have any thoughts for Shakina?
Yes, absolutely. Shakina, it's nice to meet you. By the way, I've deliberately put myself in African American neighborhoods, and I've lived in Native American reservations and so forth, partly to educate myself as to what life is like for many other communities, but partly to see how the media is targeted in those communities. And, of course, the youth are a community now, as you mentioned it, somewhat fragmented with their own culture. And so the word target is an interesting one in the first place. How can you be loving or caring or, you know, at least collegial toward people who you are, quote, targeting? It's kind of like shooting in photography. We borrow language that betrays us in those situations. Money is a primary motivation. Whenever you can find a market that doesn't think for itself, like 3-, 4-, 5-year-olds, and where parenting is not as strong as it used to be, we used to have what we call the nuclear family. Now we have more people living together who are not married than are married. Now we have a higher rate of child abuse. We have a higher rate of adults who are alcoholics, who are drug dependent, and so forth and so on. So children don't have the same degree of overall caregiving as they had before. And if I were going to be a child predator, a marketer, someone who wanted to sell things to people who sometimes have the power to persuade their own parents, children would be a way to go if I didn't have an ethical constraint mechanism, because that's a lot of dollars when you're going after children, just like when you're going after a market that no one else is going after, or going after a market that basically will generate income for you for the rest of your life. If you can sell a cigarette to a child, which is illegal but doesn't stop cigarette advertisers, you've got a customer for life. So there are a lot of reasons why children are vulnerable in that area.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go next to Marianne in Denton. Hi, Marianne.
Oh, hi. I wanted to comment on the fact that I'm a middle school teacher, and I teach what's called information and communication, tech, to 6th through 8th grade. And we have constant internet at, you know, every student's seat. And I have really noticed that a lot of the educational programs are really what I would call edutainment. They're loud, they're bright, they're fast. And I'm beginning to think that we keep saying we have more ADD kids, but I think they might be overstimulated along the lines that your guest is talking about, to the point where I've implemented something that kind of fits into what the discussion is, and that is about once a month I have a no-tech, low-tech day where the kids can play board games, we'll go outside, we'll do real puzzles with, you know, physical pieces, but no internet and no computers. And I'm going to hang up, but I wanted to say at first the kids hated the idea, but then we've talked about, you know, the trade-offs and what they have gained and given up, you know, when they use the internet. So that is my comment, but I've really appreciated this discussion.
Well, thanks so much for your call, Marianne. You know, it is interesting to think about, it's almost a chicken and egg question, isn't it, that the attention spans of kids today and then the media that they're consuming on a regular basis?
Absolutely. And I do want to comment on what she has to say about being a creative educator. I applaud what you're doing by inventing your own curriculum there and so forth. Many people use this book in the classroom for just that reason, because it allows you a number of ways that you can go with children other than the conventional ones. And many people who don't use this book are nevertheless doing exactly what you're doing, thinking for themselves about ways for children to use something other than their handheld all the time, or other than the DVDs that are programmed into the curriculum, so that they're constantly having the experience of flexibility, creativity, of originality. Richard Louv has a book out now about nature deficit disorder, that our children just don't have the same kind of relation to nature that they should have, that we used to have, and so forth. And so there are a lot of reasons to vary the curriculum, if not to use books like this, then to use the ideas that both of us are talking about. So I appreciate that.
I want to ask you about this, Tom. The word addiction has come up multiple times over this hour. Do people giving up, even on a temporary basis, media to which they have become, if addicted is too strong a word, on which they've become dependent, do they experience some kind of psychological withdrawal symptoms when they first start something like this?
Absolutely. And I do want to point out that the word addiction is being used somewhat clinically here. Mm-hmm. We used to use it as a metaphor when we studied media, that it was very different than addiction to foods or to drugs or to alcohol and so forth. But actually, several of the serious researchers in our field began to use the term media addiction because it did go through those kind of cycles, because many people do have withdrawal symptoms, and because there's a difference between addiction and habituation. Habituation, you can take it or leave it. You may have the habit, but something important comes up, and you go do that. Addiction, you have the habit, something important comes up, and you have to sustain your addiction. And so we even use terms from clinical psychology like dosage. George Gerbner is one of the greatest thinkers and experimenters and so forth in terms of media violence and what that's doing to our children. He uses the term dosage very deliberately. Rambo 1 shows 100 dead bodies. Rambo 3, in order to compete, has to show 400 dead bodies and killings and so forth. That's just like increasing the dosage in a drug situation. So the language can be more or less specifically adopted, even though in many cases what we have is not addiction, but habituation or dependency.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we will speak with Ian in Fort Worth. Hi, Ian.
Oh, hello. Yes, I was thinking I was quite unusual by having switched off the internet 2 years ago. But from your callers, it sounds like it's not all that uncommon. I started on the internet in 93, and it was a very, very different place then. It was a very small number of users in England. And I don't know, over the years, I began to find that the users that were coming on and emails I was getting, the intellectual level was really dropping way down. More and more people, less and less smart people, you know. And also I got a bit sick of all the commercialism, that commercialization that came into the net. So about 2 years ago, I just thought, well, I'm not really enjoying this anymore, switch off. And I can't say I've regretted it. I have talking books, I have satellite radio, some of the programs on your station, including Think, talking books, talking magazines. So I don't really go without any stimulation, really.
Well, thank you so much for your call, Ian.
Cheers.
You know, Tom, it is interesting that the internet didn't used to be something that everybody was on. The same thing with cell phones. And now they've really sort of taken over life in the way that, you know, Ian's decision is interesting, because a lot of people would say, well, I could give up TV or I could give up some other things, but I couldn't live without the internet.
And it all depends on how you look at it.
Yeah.
The great French philosopher, Blaise Pascal, said all human problems reduce to one, our inability to live quietly in one small room. We seek distraction. So for some people, the internet is the universe, but for other people, it's a distraction, as all media are, from solving the problems of our lives. Something feels good, it's comfortable, it's convenient, and it's like the syrup we pour over the waffles and pancakes. We never get to who's underneath our false emotions and false experiences. We may have relationships in our lives that need attention. We may have serious economic or other problems. In fact, if you magnify that on the global scale, the world has a very serious situation right now. Several of them, in fact. They begin with E for the most part: energy, economy, environment, so forth. We may not be here a lot longer. I'm not a doomsdayer, but if you add all the science up together, you'll find that most people feel we're living on borrowed time, or soon should be. And so are we entertaining ourselves to death while the Titanic is sinking? Should our major media story be about survival and about, you know, pro-social things that we can do for each other and for other species? And so are we being distracted to a point of where what's really serious, what's really important, what needs to be done becomes trivial? And what's trivial, like entertainment, becomes everything.
Well, you know, that quote that you mentioned about the inability to live quietly in one small room, it seems that that's a metaphor. The one small room is in our own heads, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's a metaphor for consciousness. If you're religious, it's a metaphor for your relationship with a higher power. If you're not, it's still about consciousness and about what you could be doing for humanity.
So how do you balance the fact that you are a media professional and yet you want to be very mindful about what you consume? On the other hand, you need to know what's out there. How have you sort of approached all of this balance in your own life?
So thank you for asking that, because for me, it's not about abstaining from media. I am a media professor. I want to give deep thanks for the paychecks I get all the time for analyzing the media and writing books about media books and all of that stuff. So there's no hypocrisy here in that regard. I love the media, and I'm a self-proclaimed kind of media scholar, media addict to some degree in some areas. But my interest is, how do we use the media creatively? A lot of people who take a media fast who are producers or hosts or writers or talent come back from their media fast and use the media in a better way. It's not a matter of getting rid of it. So that's my bias. My bias is balance, how to be the creator within the context of using whatever medium. Some of us use paint. Some of us use notes. Some of us use television. Some of us film, the internet, so forth. They're all great creative tools. They're not the problem. It's whether or not we're the consumer or the creator. I ask my students, do you want to have on your tombstone, consumed 1,000 episodes of Survivor? or do you want to have on your tombstone, made a difference,
You
know, helped humanity? Or if you're religious, did something for your God or your, you know, your power, your heart, whatever it is for you. If you're an artist, made people see the world differently. If you're a writer, made people think, you know. So what is it that's in you, the music that's buried in you that's trying to come out? How do you get to that rather than keep overlaying it by being a pincushion for all this electronic stimuli?
Thomas W. Cooper is professor of visual and media arts at Emerson College and founder of the Association for Responsible Communication. His new book is called Fast Media, Media Fast, How to Clear Your Mind and Invigorate Your Life in an Age of Media Overload. Tom, it's been a very interesting discussion, obviously struck a chord with our listeners, so I really appreciate you spending this hour with us.
I appreciate you and your listeners. Thanks, everybody, for the good questions.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.